Welcome to the Passive House podcast, brought to you by Passive House Accelerator, a catalyst for zero carbon building. For news, inspiration, and connections from all flavors of Passive House, check out passivehouseaccelerator.com. Sign up to receive regular updates about events, get your technical questions answered, and contribute to the community forum. There's loads of free information for experienced professionals and people just starting out on their Passive House journey. We hope to see you at one of our construction tech or weekly global Passive House showcase webinars. In the meantime, here's this week's Passive House podcast.
Welcome to episode 93 of the Passive House podcast. And today we have a very special interview conducted by Ilka Cassidy and Mary James for the Passive House podcast. I'm Zach Semke, and our co-host Matthew Cutler Welsh is traveling today, so he's unable to join us. Ilka is also about to be traveling extensively, so she can't make it. So it's Mary and me with you today. Mary, how's it going? And you're kind of in a special spot right now. Where are you?
I'm in Toronto for the Retrofit Canada conference, which starts tomorrow morning, and I'm really excited about it. There's a lot of policy work that is in process and a lot of support of retrofits in Canada, and I'm excited to be a part of the conference and sharing the information about that.
Indeed. And I mean, retrofits has been kind of your professional focus for a little while now. So this must be super exciting for you.
It is. It's just the fact that there is a conference whose name is Retrofit Canada. That sort of sums up some of the excitement I'm feeling. Like, no longer are retrofits thought of as one-off projects, but, you know, how do we approach this systematically to make retrofits easier and less costly as a whole? And what policies are needed, what educational approaches are needed. It's exciting that there's this level of thinking about retrofits now. So,
well, that's a great tee up, I think, to the interview that we're about to hear. But before we get into that, I'm going to thank some sponsors that make everything we do at the Accelerator happen. So a big thank you to our founding sponsors, 475 High Performance Building Supply, Baxt Ingwe Architects, Glavel Foam Glass Gravel, Minotaur All-in-One HVAC and Dehumidification Units, Mitsubishi Electric Train HVAC US, Partel, Rockwell North America, Stocorp, and Zola Windows. Thank you also to our champion sponsors, Icon Windows and Doors and Prosico, and thank you to our stakeholder partner, NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. So big thank you. So Mary, please introduce our guest here.
So we're speaking with Sophie Tremblay, who is with LGA Architectural Partners in Toronto. And she has worked on, most recently her focus has been on deep energy retrofits of towers in Toronto. So, it's really quite an exciting expertise that she's developing.
Indeed. Okay, let's dive into the interview.
Well, welcome, Sophie Tremblay. Thank you very much for joining us. And you are with LGA Architectural Partners in Toronto, Canada.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Hello. Let's start with the geographic diversity of your education. You've studied in Montreal, Istanbul, and Paris. Can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up studying in all those places?
Yeah, so I grew up in Montreal. And so in university, there was a program between France and Quebec, which you could apply for, and you would get to study your entire third year in Paris. And so as soon as I heard about that, I applied for it and then was accepted. And so that was how I ended up in Paris for a year. And then similarly, I studied in Ottawa for my master's, and there was a program, a relationship between Alton University and Istanbul Technical University. And so I pushed for going there as well. So yeah, they were two really great experiences.
So what's the difference, or what would you say is the difference, you know, going there to study compared to your time in Montreal before?
I mean, I think especially as a young student in architecture, being in Europe and in cities that are much older, and just seeing so much more architecture, not to dismiss, you know, older architecture, like just different ideas. Education system was completely different as well, in both places. And so, yeah, just really formative experiences.
And in Istanbul, there must have been very different experiences. I mean, how was it both from an educational perspective, being there as a woman student, and but also as Istanbul is on the kind of border between Asia and Europe, architecturally, how was it being there?
Yeah, Istanbul, even, I mean, the language barrier was something. Like when I, some of my courses, one of them was called, I think, Philosophy and Architecture. And I was the only, it was really interesting. I was the only kind of non-Turkish speaking student. And so often they would kind of, I would speak and I presented and then they would all discuss in Turkish. So it was interesting. Yeah, I mean, Istanbul being kind of between Europe and Asia, really, really old city. So really interesting how they deal with heritage in architecture. And what I remember from my semester there, I did this research project on not Tower Bowl, but like the creation of these suburban towers. So basically the government in Istanbul was kind of clearing out crowded neighborhoods in the inner city, and they were building towers for them outside of the city. So really kind of tough for you know, poorer populations living in there. And they were doing really the same thing that had happened in France, in a lot of European and Western countries in the 60s and 70s. So a lot of the same kind of mistakes and challenges. And so I was looking into these neighborhoods and also kind of the creation of informal settlements happening in different areas all over the city as well.
And in terms of energy efficiency, was there anything that was taught there or in Paris?
You know what? No. I think a lot of this I'm hearing now in the University of Toronto, like it's starting to make its way into schools. And it's, you know, a recent grad in my office did her thesis on kind of the different type of concrete and the environmental impacts and just really getting technical into products and carbon footprint. When I was in school, it was all about concepts. It was all about the aesthetics, the design. Like we had like the sustainability course, which is really interesting, you know, more about orientation, lighting, shading kind of thing. But, and then there was these few technologies that were kind of, but they were overlooked by the practitioners and the professors that we had. It was much more about strength of your concept and yeah.
I mean, it's kind of interesting because Istanbul, I mean, the climate is very, very different, right? So, and a lot of times there's already inherent in these concepts that they're, you know, that universities are teaching some kind of bioclimatic approaches. Is that something that they taught, or was climate not really part of the conversation?
Not really. I mean, even though there's amazing examples of like in Cappadocia in the east part of Turkey, there's all these old dwellings carved in the rocks. Really, really interesting. I did go there to visit. But no, nothing really in my education. I guess it was over 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I did have one course actually. Yes, one course in Carleton University by this professor was really about sustainability. And that's what I remember starting to be very, like it shocked me, like all the stats and just global warming and all of it kind of really sunk in. And since that time, I've been much more concerned and concerned about it.
Yeah. And you went from your studies to your first job in architecture, which focused more on urban design and transportation projects. Can you tell us a little bit about those that you worked on?
Yeah, I was part of the team in a Montreal office working on the Montreal airport. So we were actually based within the airport, working kind of directly with all consultants, the client, and everyone there. We were at the time building the future train station to receive the train from Montreal, but it hasn't, the train hasn't come yet. That was a while ago.
These infrastructure projects take years and years.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, and then it sounds like you shifted your focus a little bit more towards community housing and non-profit projects. So what inspired that shift?
Yeah, I think, I mean, since school, I think I was just trying to find a way to have a bit more impact, I think, through my career and profession. Like when you graduate from school, you're kind of very idealistic and then you start work and it's not so, you're disillusioned very quickly, mm-hmm. I can put it this way. Yeah. And I think at least with like LG focuses really on that type of work. And that's why I was really interested in joining this practice. We do a lot of work with First Nations communities here in Canada, all over the country, and a lot of non-for-profits and affordable housing providers. Sorry. So yeah, it just feels like the work isn't glamorous for these projects, but you know we meet with the tenants, and these are people that, you know, are on subsidized housing. And so the impact you have on their lives is really something that I do like working in these projects for that aspect of it. And I think, I mean, this, similarly with Passive House, I think my interest is also in the impact it can have and that it has on, you know, people's comfort, lives, and just climate as well, right? Like it just seems like the right thing to do.
So how did you hear about Passive House and how did you get interested in that?
Yeah, I think we all kind of knew about it from Germany, like vaguely throughout mm-hmm. school and just years practicing, but it really gained momentum here in Canada in the past couple years, I think. Like that's when I started hearing colleagues and peers from different firms. They were all kind of certifying people and it was really gaining in popularity. And at the same time, we're getting clients interested in us doing these projects. There's a few currently in the office. Clients want to be as close as possible to certification, but they're not in the certification process. We have net zero projects as well, which are increasingly just coming up. And it really relates as well to the current funding available. And the City of Toronto just is launching this kind of pilot deep retrofit challenge. So
in a way, you're trying to connect those pieces of the community housing and non-for-profit projects with Passive House principles, even if you're not certifying all the way?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. I think, and I think it's just about to come. Like it's going to happen very soon. I think in the office, a few of us are getting certified and you can see the interest increasing in clients. And I think, yeah, my job after the training will be to kind of advocate and push for it and try and, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, some of the projects that you've been working on now are retrofits, but a larger scale retrofit than people normally think of when they think of retrofits. So can you tell us a little bit about the retrofit projects you've been working on?
Yeah. So they are existing multi-unit apartment buildings. They range from townhouse, you know, 20, 30 units to towers. I have a tower, 27 stories and 468 units, all occupied buildings. So trying to do as deep a retrofit as possible on an existing building. We'll typically add insulation, overclad the entire building with about 5-6 inches of insulation, new windows, new doors, new air barrier, obviously prior insulation and cladding. And then we also retrofit the existing mechanical systems in order to improve fresh air, provide fresh air. In a lot of cases, there isn't. So often that's quite a challenging one, to provide new fresh air in an existing occupied building. And then in terms of the heating systems, some upgrades, sometimes full system change is contemplated, but typically more of a, you know, providing radiator controls like thermostats for residents. And just as a result of the retrofit, we can go with low condensing equipment. And so it's not like full heat or full, you know, stop. So those are the typical upgrades they're working on.
Are the motivations of your clients, are they to, you know, energy savings and cost savings associated, or is it resiliency during extreme events, or comfort because summers are getting hotter, or what would you say are the main motivating factors?
Yeah, I would say all of that. I mean, the two main motivators would be for sure energy savings, but also just durability, like being able to holistically retrofit their building allows them to not have to come back to it every year for significant maintenance and repairs, and just know what to expect. Because a lot of these buildings are falling apart a bit. You can see it visually, like the masonry is just, everything is in really poor shape. And so their approach, that specific client used to be more just because of not enough funding, you know, just kind of repair approach, component replacement approach. And now they're able to do these larger retrofits, which is great. It's tough for the tenants though. It's really tough. Couple of years of construction often, and you know it's quite disruptive, especially in the past few years, people working at home and staying home a lot.
And these are generally long-term tenants that they expect to be there afterwards, or you know,
it really depends. It's hard to say. Like we've met some that have been there 35 years and have seen it. But other things, there's much more turnover.
Yeah. Well, it just makes the living through the construction worth it if you're going to be there for a while longer.
But yeah, no, it's hard. Like in some projects, we're contemplating evacuating buildings. And I think it's not a bad approach because you can do, it's hard and they have to find spots for people to move temporarily, but at the same time, it allows you to do much, much more. And I think that if any of these projects will be able to achieve passive house, it's going to require potentially an evacuation just for things like airtightness testing and the balconies, like the window, like rough openings. Like we often cannot modify too much the rough opening, but that means you can't really do as good of a job in dealing with these kind of thermal bridge conditions.
So what are typically the damages or the damage that you see on those old buildings? Is that based, you know, is it really mold based on thermal bridge issues, or is it just kind of the building, the brick, as you said, falling apart?
Yeah, there's a range of issues. I mean, in terms of the envelope, often there's been kind of water leakage in some areas. Often they've added like a stucco 20 years ago that just made things worse over masonry. Mold definitely on the inside sometimes. Even structural issues, like bricks falling, things like that, if it's been kind of in disrepair for too long. And obviously window, I mean, condensation, wind, everything going through those old windows.
Yeah. And then the new windows, are you going all the way to like triple glazed, or is there a limit to what you can do?
There's always a limit. This is one of the things. This is one of the things I think we can push for, and especially if we need to meet kind of higher energy efficiency standards. Typically in multi-unit high-rise buildings, we can't really go with anything else than aluminum windows. I know there's recent examples of fiberglass, and I'm really hoping that's something we can also push for. But with aluminum, you get a bit less performance than you would with other products. And triple glaze, not yet. I keep doing it as an alternate price. So yeah, hopefully soon.
Well, at least you can mention it, right? And put it in people's heads that it's there and it's available and maybe it can happen for the next project.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you mentioned funding earlier. Like, who funds those renovations?
Yeah, so the main client we work with is Toronto Community Housing, which is a government-funded agency. So, you know, the management, the repairs, everything in their projects is publicly funded. So, mm-hmm. so recently, all their funding mainly comes from accessibility upgrades and energy upgrades. And so, depending on how high the target is, that kind of really trickles down to what you can do and the mm-hmm. cost that they will allocate per project. So, that's why some more high performing things are hard to justify if the target isn't high enough, basically.
So who sets the targets?
A lot of it will come from the federal government. And I was just mentioning earlier that net zero project. I mean, it's things like that we want to see. Like, I think as the government is trying to, like currently the federal government, I think are trying to push the agenda to invest more in a transition and better retrofits that actually have a bigger impact, then we're seeing more funding coming in.
It's great to see from here that Canada, it does seem like there's more funding being allocated for improving buildings in a, you know, fairly planned out way, which is great because there's also the climate action targets for I think that each province has that they're trying to meet. So,
it's political in the end. So currently, it's okay. I think we've had 10 years of conservative government here in Canada, and Ontario currently has a conservative government as well, and so that poses challenges to more climate forward policies.
You had mentioned previously that you started your Pass Fast training, but you're not done with it yet. Are there significant lessons that you've learned from the training so far, or are they familiar to you from what you've been doing in your practices? Or
yeah, I think, I mean, a lot of it is familiar and kind of all the general principles were already understood. I think it's more in the details that I'm starting to get really good ideas, and I'm excited to see how, like, what are the next couple years really from this point, and especially if we get a few of those jobs and retrofits, be interesting to see how we can apply some of these principles. Like, the course so far is I think there's more single family passive house projects, like, in general. I could be wrong. I know in Canada, like, the course is more focused on single family. And so there's different challenges with non-combustible high-rise construction. I'm excited to see what we come up with.
Right. Well, certainly single family, there's more of a history of single family passive houses, but I think there's a pretty big, large uptick in multifamily passive house at this point.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, even just some of the strict requirements for air testing, like, we're starting to see it in our projects. We're starting to do it, but it's quite new, right? It's not something you would just do on any project, but it's already kind of starting to happen. So that is something I think we can just apply to other jobs. Like, it doesn't need to be passive house to require that kind of thing. I think a lot of principles can just transfer.
So how about
they should?
How about contractors? Are they willing and educated to basically fulfill the details that you come up with?
So on the current projects, for the current deep retrofit projects, no. We may have got one good one. it's a real challenge. Yeah. I think especially the contractors that were doing these projects before, more of the repair approach, they kind of carried on right now. So we're in a transition where like the design engineering department and us are trying to push for, you know, higher performance. And then as soon as we get into construction, we kind of have this old guard of like people we're dealing with, and the contractor quality is not great. So yeah, it's a big challenge right now. We've tried since the beginning to kind of make our specs bulletproof, and we just really push, you know, we push them, especially like they just tried to substitute good windows on me last week and I was not happy. We're pushing back, but it does require better contractors, more training, you know. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything being put in place for more training? Because I mean, that's definitely key to making it all work.
Definitely. I think once we, like, if you do a project which requires a certification like Passive House, it's actually a bit of the key to getting also better quality during construction. I think it is, because it gives you the arguments. They need to pass these tests post-construction, right? They need to pass these things during construction. And so it's not only a design thing where you've designed everything and then they do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. So I think it'll be really key in getting the quality delivered.
No, I mean, I think that's definitely an argument for going through certification, right? Because we do it all where clients would like to go towards Passive House as close as possible, but not really going through certification. And I totally understand it. But what a lot of people don't see is that once you do certification, I mean, there's just a third party involved, and you actually have quite a bit of leverage as the client and as the architect over, you know, the builder or whoever has to execute the construction. And it's kind of nice to have that in your back pocket, because there's no, you know, if the client is paying for it, there is not a good reason not to pass those tests, right? You kind of have to, and that is quality controlled and tested at the end.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's really critical. Yeah.
And even having air tightness testing, even if you're not going for a Passive House certification per se, but if you have a really set air tightness target, it can help, again, as Ilka said, have leverage with the contractors, you know.
Definitely. Yep. That's,
yeah. And you see you're starting to do air tightness testing in your projects?
Yeah, like not on my projects yet, like the ones we were doing with this client, but on other projects, it's happening on other projects. Yeah.
That's great. Well, it's definitely a movement forward, you know, and Toronto is, you know, is in the forefront in many regards. It's exciting what they're sort of what's happening there in your city.
It's true. Like the Toronto Green Standard's been there for a long time already, and there's all these tiers basically of sustainability, and it's a program that was planned, you know, for, it's like an incremental approach that was kind of implemented, and you knew that it would be from tier 1, 2, 3, 4, and I think we're already in 4, and it's getting pretty pretty close to, you know, something like Passive House.
And Toronto is the city where the upcoming Retrofit Canada conference is based, which is
true,
going to be an exciting event with lots of great content. So it's great to talk with you about your deep energy retrofits and the work that you're doing, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it as well.
And I hope a lot of people are encouraged to just you know, do whatever they can and push clients and contractors and nudge everyone a little bit forward, right?
Agreed.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
So that was Sophie Tremblay. Great conversation, Mary. What were some of your key takeaways?
Well, I have to start off with how exciting it is to have a young professional who has so much knowledge already in deep energy retrofits, and also is someone who's taken the Passive House training. She's just getting engaged with the Passive House training, partly in response to client interest in Passive House approaches. So, hey, what a big step that is. That's great.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. I was struck by that, the clear foundation that she has in deep energy retrofit already, and also excitement to be applying some of the, she was talking about the details that she was learning in her training with Passive House, and her excitement about applying those to future projects. I also was struck by how critical, especially in her realm where she's doing a lot of subsidized housing work, how critical that target setting that's happening, you know, either at the federal level or other municipalities like at the City of Toronto level, and that just how much those policy decisions and moves kind of set the guardrails for what a practitioner is doing.
Yes, Sophie alluded to that one of her projects is setting a path to net zero for one of their social housing projects. And, you know, I think Passive House approach is going to be super helpful in trying to achieve that target. And that target was set by the Toronto, as I understand, by the Toronto Municipal Housing Authority, which, I mean, really getting the cities or any level of government on board with setting these aggressive targets for retrofits, that's really a new development.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously a critically important one, given how much of our building emissions come from all these existing buildings, these buildings that she talks about kind of that are currently falling apart. So there's an urgency on many levels, on a climate level, but also just simply on a kind of building safety and maintenance level to have a rebirth happen with each of these buildings. So those policies and funding, of course, with retrofit is so important. And then another thing that I think came through really clearly was the role of certification in helping to ensure that buildings, the Passive House buildings, Passive House retrofits are being built as drawn. She was talking about, and this is, I think, true for whenever we see an innovation happen in the construction space. I mean, there's a lot of learning that needs to happen on all sorts of levels, including with contractors and builders. And there's this, I think a little bit of a sense of, hey, we've been doing it for, you know, decades this way. Why do we have to change? And she voiced some frustration, but also the realization that when you have to be gunning for a certification, that suddenly there's a little bit more leverage to ensure that windows aren't swapped out at the last moment from high performance to not high performance, or that air tightness strategies are actually adhered to, and that sort of thing.
Yes, especially the air tightness, because it's such a clear-cut testing that, you know, either you achieve the target or you don't. And if you don't, well, if the target's been set, you have to go back and fix it. So yeah, it's a big help to have those very clear targets that you have to meet.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Well, just the whole the resiliency to future climate events that these retrofits are, you know, helping the residents to be able to experience. I mean, as I'm in Toronto right now, we're having a heat warning here, and you know, these buildings that are falling apart are, I'm sure, not comfortable in this heat wave.
Yeah.
But with these retrofits, it's going to be, I think that's another big incentive to get them done. And thank goodness we have people like Sophie who have the experience to get them done right rather than getting them done and then without building science and then having to redo them because the brick is falling off or the stucco is crumbling. So yeah, it's great. It's great to have these talented people contributing to making our building environment more livable.
Well said. It's so true. And thank you for the interview with Sophie. And these monthly interviews that you and Ilka conduct are such a highlight on the podcast. So a big, big thank you for the work that both of you are doing to make these happen. Also to listeners, thanks for tuning in to the Passive House podcast. I have a couple of announcements that we want to share before we close up on at the Passive House Accelerator. Our Passive House Accelerator Live program, which is on Wednesday, our time Thursday, if you're in Australia and New Zealand, will feature a presentation that I'm going to do actually called Putting the Punk into Passive House. This will be kind of a condensed version of that four-part video series that I published recently, and a condensed version plus a lot of conversation. So this will be a chance to have some discussion and kind of think about the future of climate change, the role of buildings, and this whole notion of solar punk as well. So I hope that you'll join us at Passive House Accelerator Live this week for that. And then on June 28th and 29th, we have not the Passive House Accelerator, but we as a broad community have the Net Zero Build Summit 2022, which is bringing together the net zero community in the Midwest to discuss challenges, opportunities, innovations, policy changes, and other developments regarding net zero design. So we'll include a little link to that in show notes for that. And I think that pretty much wraps it up for us for this episode of the Passive House podcast. Thanks again, Mary.
Thank you, Zach. And I'm looking forward to next week's Passive House Live. That should be really fun and a nice antidote to some of the depressing news that we are seeing and hearing about. It's great to, I like this solar punk attitude.
Awesome. Well, yeah, it should be a fun conversation. Great. Well, everyone, please tune in next week again for the next episode of Passive House Podcast. And until then, be well.